The Guardian.
The Corbyn surge was real, and Theresa May has been humiliated. She tried to bury the Labour Party, and instead she has destroyed her premiership.
Britain has once again awoken to a completely altered political landscape. No strong and stable government, instead a chaotic, hung parliament.
So what has happened, and what happens next? I'm Heather Stewart.
I'm Owen Jones.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland.
So as we sit here at lunchtime on Friday, this is what we know. The final tally is Labour on 262 seats, the Conservatives on 318, and so no party has an overall majority. We should just note that the People's Republic of Kensington and Chelsea has just fallen to the Labour column. Now, Theresa May has been forced to scrape together a deal with the Democratic Unionist Party in order to stay in chaos. It's worth just taking a moment here, isn't there?
Stay in office, I think. You said stay in chaos, which may be right.
Oh, well, that's what I was going to say.
But it may be right.
Bear in mind, I'm virtually hallucinating, sorry. It's astonishing, really, this, isn't it? I mean, where do you begin? In terms of what we now face, after Theresa May called a vanity election with the sole purpose of crushing all opposition in this country to wipe out the main opposition party as an electoral force, that was her aim, we have, obviously, the reality of her going backwards and the Labour Party advancing. Labour have got the biggest share of the vote, perhaps since 1997. It depends if they've eclipsed the 2001 level of about 41%. Now, the outcome, therefore, means, just to focus on the Tories, is we have a coalition of chaos. A coalition of chaos between the Conservatives, who are broken and humiliated, with a Prime Minister whose authority is in tatters, and a party which is, I would say, unequivocally anti-LGBT rights, anti-women's rights, and has links to Northern Irish extremists.
Who could that be? It's funny, isn't it? I mean, that was one of the big claims, wasn't it? The Tories had that it will be a coalition of chaos and that he'll be in the pocket of one of the minor parties from the fringe of the UK. And exactly the point you made, that he would be linked to extremists associated with Ireland. And you would have thought, okay, well, you must be describing Jeremy Corbyn. But instead, it's turned out to be Theresa May. I think this thing with the DUP is really something the Democratic Unionist Party, because nobody outside Northern Ireland really ever even looks at the manifestos of these parties. They're barely aware of them. And suddenly, this is going to be holding up the whole government.
Yeah, we've been doing quite a bit of swatting up, I have to say, having not spent a great deal of time thinking about the DUP's manifesto before now. It's also worth pointing out, I think, that part of her rationale for calling this election and gambling on this election was to silence some of the disquiet in her own party and some of the opposition with her in her own party. Because if she could say, here's my personal mandate, you know, she very much made this her battle, her personal battle, then she'd be able to say to some of these sort of sceptical backbenchers, look, you know, I got you here, I got you this mandate, you know, fall into line. And instead, today, we've already seen the sort of divisions exposed with some of those, and Nicky Morgan and so on, who she sacked and who've been critics of hers in the past and who stayed very quiet during the campaign, saying, you know, the buck stops at the top. And although they're not saying she should step down now, they're certainly saying she doesn't think she can fight another general election. And then the Tories will have to think about leadership.
I mean, I do think on the DUP point, I think it is genuinely alarming. I like to describe them as the political wing of the 17th century.
They're very socially conservative, aren't they?
Exceptionally so. On LGBT rights, obviously the opposition to women's right to choose. But in terms of her backbenchers, you're absolutely right. She's over a barrel now by the DUP and by her own backbenchers, who have no reason whatsoever to respect her authority. She did a speech just now saying that what Britain needs is certainty. She must be livid with the Theresa May who called a vanity snap general election, which backfired so dramatically and led to this situation in the first place.
Well, with the Democratic Unionists now holding the balance of power, we thought we should catch up with our colleague in Belfast, Henry MacDonald, and we did that earlier.
The Democratic Unionist Party were formed in the 1970s, early 70s, by Ian Paisley. It was a very hardline pro-unionist party. It has evolved. It has become the biggest single force in unionism. It has a evangelical Christian base. So a lot of its policies are socially conservative. So it's opposed to gay marriage in Northern Ireland, the only part of the UK where gay marriage is not legally recognised. It has blocked abortion reform. On the other hand, they are also more inclined to be in favour of public spending, so they'll be looking for maybe less spending cuts and maybe some more money injected into the Northern Ireland economy. DUP are pro-Brexit party. I think they'll be, you know, looking to see no special status for Northern Ireland. They'll be very much opposed to a border poll, a poll on Irish reunification, which Sinn Féin have been demanding. I think that the Tories will probably give them that there won't be a border poll in the lifetime of this Parliament. They'll be looking for extra spending in terms of Northern Ireland's block grant. It gets billions from the Treasury every year to shore up the economy here. So they're in a very strong position. They've got 10 MPs. They're a very coherent, unified bunch. There's no splitters. There are no factions. They sing from the same hymn sheet, quite literally, given their religious base, their fundamentalist Christian base. And I think they will exert major influence. And the key thing is how much influence, and will that influence alienate the major nationalist party now, the dominant force of Irish nationalism in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin.
So Henry MacDonald raising the point about how that leaves Sinn Féin. Since Sinn Féin are abstaining from sitting in the House of Commons, it doesn't really have a bearing directly on the arithmetic, except it means Theresa May needs fewer seats in order to get a working majority. But I'm really interested, Heather, in the whole thing of the DUP and Brexit, because there is this notion that, yes, they're a pro-Brexit party, but some have wondered if they might be, for their own kind of Northern Irish reasons, interested in a slightly softer Brexit than the ones that, you know, Theresa May is going to be under pressure from. But it just adds to this sort of 27 dimensional geometry she's going to have, where she's got to accommodate John Redwood and Bill Cash at one end. She's got to keep Anna Soubry and Nicky Morgan on hand, the sort of more softer, you know, Remainers, and now the DUP in the mix. I mean, how do you see it all working out with Brexit?
It is complex, and I think the two things they are concerned about is they certainly don't want a hard border, a hard customs border, and they don't want a separate deal for Northern Ireland, you know, as opposed to the rest of the UK with Brexit. And if you put the two of those things together, it possibly makes it hard to have a hard customs border around the outside of the rest of the UK. So it definitely complicates.
Do they want no special arrangement because it undermines the sort of Britishness of Ulster?
I think so, yeah, exactly.
They want to be the same as everyone else.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it's worth noting Northern Ireland overall voted against Brexit. Of course, the two exceptions were Scotland and Northern Ireland. And although the DUP is the dominant unionist party, the unionist voters, the unionist electorate, aren't united around the idea of Brexit either. It's very divisive within Northern Ireland, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and as it's divisive, you know, within the Tory party here, as it's divisive in Scotland, it's an incredibly complicated picture, and it means with the talks due to start very soon, it's very hard to represent Britain's view at that table, which is what Theresa May says she intends to do.
But my other worry is, could this put pressure on the Northern Ireland peace process, whereby you have effectively one, the most radical wing of unionism now has huge leverage over the British government and will use that leverage undoubtedly to achieve its partisan ends in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, and you wonder, we were saying earlier, you know, it's presumably too small a block for them to be able to demand any kind of ministerial post. But, you know, for example, if you had them in Northern Ireland, Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, it would be an extraordinary situation. They could possibly do it. But, you know, it does, you feel there's a kind of conflict of interest there, or it's problematic,
I think,
to say
I
the
sort
least.
Of think for that reason they're going to avoid a formal capital C coalition.
Probably.
Because exactly that, how would you give them a government post? But instead it will be the so-called confidence and supply. You just know they're there for the numbers. They buttress you for the numbers. And that probably will be in the DUP's own interest as well. I don't think they would necessarily want to be there. But it was very striking, wasn't it, when Theresa May made her, I was about to say, resignation statement. It wasn't a resignation statement.
It looked as if it might be one for a moment.
We had the optics of
her husband, yeah.
But the two amazing things about it. I mean, the first one was she literally did not refer to the election. It was as if it was June the 24th, 2016.
Extraordinary.
She only talked about the Brexit referendum and how she was going to implement that. But the other really striking thing, it was just a small thing, but she said, we in the Conservative and Unionist Party, reminding people, it's not a name she's used often, a brand name. She was trying to suggest, look, we're a natural fit for the DUP.
Yes, they're and just we were saying we've worked together for years.
Yeah, for years.
Perfectly
and they're
natural,
almost
yeah.
our branch office. You know, they're the sort of Tories in Northern Ireland. So it's very, nothing to see here. But overall, her message, this kind of nothing has changed message, just did seem a little delusional.
I can't see how this is sustainable. I mean, just imagine, you know, Prime Minister's questions. Now, what we've seen in PMQs is Jeremy Corbyn often standing up, being quite a lonely figure because the PLP have been very hostile to him. So he'll stand up to the, you know, very muted applause, to say the least, whilst Theresa May has her entire parliamentary party whooping behind her. I mean, you could see how that position now could be changed. The Parliamentary Labour Party has every reason to stand up and cheer Jeremy Corbyn. Many of them owe their increased share to the Corbyn surge. It's just absolutely obviously the case, including those bitterly opposed to him. Whilst with what we know about the Conservative Party above all else is, I mean, you know, Macbeth doesn't cover it, does it? They take out their leaders when they are regarded as liabilities. But the issue is, how can they do that in this situation? I mean, Boris Johnson, they can't have Amber Rudd because she nearly lost her seat. What happens? How is this a sustainable situation?
When this immediately happened, I thought, okay, so now a plausible scenario, she resigns in the morning, they're into a leadership election, and then actually perhaps even a general election. The more I've thought about it afterwards, the very weight of her near defeat or the poverty of her performance actually gives her leverage over them. Because she can say to them, you can topple me if you like, you can go into an election if you like, but do you really fancy taking on this guy who's now proven he can get young people out? If you are ambitious, Boris Johnson, and want to have my job, you've got to believe that you could run against Jeremy Corbyn and, you know, perhaps lose and throw it all away. And I think they'll be nervous about doing it in a kind of turkeys voting for Christmas way.
And also, would you like your name stamped all over this rather difficult Brexit deal and stamped all over the economic downturn that already seems to be coming and the declining living standards that we're already starting to bite? I mean, it's quite interesting. I don't think I think you're right. I think they would far rather push her out in front and let her take
the pain. I mean, that's what she may say. She may say, look, I'm obviously finished. I'm never going to do another election. Leave me here as Prime Minister. I'll absorb all the pain. And who knows, in 5 years' time, by then, Corbyn may have gone. This incredible vote-winning machine, Jeremy Corbyn, may have gone.
Well, there you go. The Tories are genuinely scared of Jeremy Corbyn.
As you so often said, Owen.
A sentence I can say without being challenged. You can leave us your thoughts on our podcast page at theguardian.com.
At this point, let's attempt a first draft of history. That's what we journalists are meant to do. And let's drill down into some of what has happened, because it caught, it's fair to say, I think pretty well everyone by surprise. It's obviously the pollsters completely wrong-footed, apart from one poll that we all dismissed as a rogue at the time from YouGov. But the parties themselves, the Conservatives weren't expecting this, Labour weren't expecting this, talking to people on the ground minutes before the exit poll, they all said the Tories had bagged a majority, the only disagreement was about the size. So it caught everyone by surprise, and we're going to have to try and explain what exactly this was about. And I noticed a lot of the foreign media are really struck by the idea this was an election after Britain had been struck not once but twice during the election campaign, with the bombing at Manchester Arena and then the attacks on London Bridge. Do we think that had an effect on this election, that somehow people didn't feel safe under Theresa May and therefore changed their vote?
Well, it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? Because I must admit, in the immediate, or, you know, in the days that followed those attacks, you hate to sort of find yourself thinking, what impact does this have? But to the extent that you wondered what impact it might have, you felt it might play badly for Jeremy Corbyn, who, you know, the Tories' big attack, their sort of big mudslinging thing against him is, this is a guy who's associated with people in the past who are terrorists, are friends of terrorists, whatever else it might be. And you sort of felt, you know, also they felt he was weak on security, you know, would he sort of protect you? And yet, somehow, because she's been Home Secretary for those years, and, you know, thus absolutely the person responsible for keeping us safe, and because it fitted into the idea of this sort of narrative of, have the public services been cut so far that it's starting to have a real impact, I think it showed her up. I think it's, you know, it's hard to know how these things will play, and people feel very emotional, but it drew a line, I think, from a sort of an austerity argument, a kind of abstract argument about austerity, to this is one of the things potentially it might mean in real life, is fewer bobbies on the beat. And of course, it's a sort of dotted line from that to, you know, not having the time or the time to chase up intelligence leads and whatever else. But Labour managed to turn it into a sort of cuts argument.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel macabre, obviously, having this discussion inevitably. But it's probably an important conversation to have nonetheless. We did have two terrorist attacks, which we're not used to, particularly in this country, in a very short period of time, not long after, of course, the attack in Westminster as well. Now, I can't help but think it probably, the effect cancelled each other out,
perhaps,
on both sides.
Yeah, perhaps.
Because if you look at the polling, in hindsight, it looks like the irresistible rise of the Labour Party from the early 20s to, as they ended up with 40%, over 40% of the electorate support. And that line, if you look at it, is relentless, and there's no real blip in it at all. Because obviously, you know, from a Labour perspective, if voters are marching into polling stations with security in their minds rather than the NHS, for example, that would be seen as a bad thing, whatever the angle.
That was certainly the thought at the time, yeah.
And in the Daily, you know, the Daily Mail, I mean, it's extraordinary, actually. And this is a real, we should talk about that, what a defeat this is for the gutter press in this country. But that was one element. But at the same time, of course, it did centre on Theresa May's record as Home Secretary, instituting cuts where she accused the police of scaremongering and crying wolf. And, you know, she was forced into a defensive. She couldn't go on there. You know, they tried the attack line, didn't they? The magic money tree. That was there. That replaced strong and stable. When she,
I think people quite like the sound of a magic money tree, actually. I'm sure that's such a bad thing.
Show me the way.
Yeah. So, you know, in that sense, I think maybe it cancelled each other out. People did think, the press is saying all these dodgy things about Jeremy Corbyn's past, and now we've got terrorism, security. And then at the same time, you had Theresa May with those cuts. So perhaps it cancelled that out, I think.
I mean, either way, it does, and this is something I'm going to be writing on later, but the idea, it just rewrites rule after rule after rule from the sort of political rule book. One of them is, you know, the Conservatives are always seen as tougher on security, tougher on crime, tougher on security and terror. And yet he seems to have upended that. And I agree with you, Heather. I think that argument he made about you can't have security on the cheap, it's a very good colloquial, immediate phrase. And I think it did sort of probably cut through.
I also think a bit, I mean, I watched the Ariana Grande concert, the One Love Manchester concert on Sunday night, which was had an amazing sort of atmosphere to it as an act of kind of collective defiance and a message of kind of love and hope and optimism and all those things. And in some ways you wonder whether that message of I don't know, collectivism and standing together and all those kinds of things is as much represents people's way of defying those terrorists and those attacks as I'm going to tear up the human, you know, human rights act if necessary and deport more terrorists.
Oh, and
you know,
I wonder whether chimed people, even with the Corbyn
maybe,
message.
Maybe.
Let's talk about some other things. I mean, the Scotland is a big result where the SNP did get 56 out of 59 seats just 2 years ago, and then suddenly took a real series of setbacks and big reductions, losing big people, Alex Salmond and Angus Robertson gone. I mean, how would we explain that in a nutshell?
Well, isn't part of it that when Nicola Sturgeon came out, just as the Prime Minister was about to trigger Article 50 and said, I want to call another independence referendum before, once we know what the Brexit deal is, but before we're out. And at the time, the sort of received wisdom was, what a brilliant strategic move. You know, she's really caught the Prime Minister off guard and she's kind of caught the mood and she's going to be able to ride this wave of kind of pro-Remain in Scotland. Actually, it seems as though actually the Scots feel like they've resolved that. They don't want to talk about it necessarily. And you know, Ruth Davidson's campaign has been absolutely about let's you know, we're to remain unionist, remain part of the UK, and let's not have a divisive referendum, which seems to have gone down, as far as we can tell, pretty well.
I mean, the Nationalists had the big mo. They had extraordinary momentum. To go from 6 seats in 2010 to 56 5 years later, it looked like history was on their side. It was only a matter of when, not if. And the problem they have now is that such a dramatic turnaround that even though probably a few years ago, if they thought they'd end up with the result they got today, they'd be delighted. It's not how it works. It's the direction of travel and the speed you're travelling that matter. And I think what we've seen, I think the polling bears this out, is a lot of the younger Scots actually turned to the Labour Party. And actually, there was one bit of polling that suggested that Labour beat the SNP amongst 18 to 24 year olds in Scotland. That just shows that a lot of people who were attracted to the idea of independence weren't doing so because of some sort of brave heart, blood and soil nationalism. It's because they wanted a break with a status quo, which they found profoundly unjust. And that's found a new receptacle.
Well, this brings me to another thing, actually. I mean, besides Scotland, is the idea of this vote being an anti-establishment, kicking against kind of vote in so many places. And I mean, I think that was true that the SNP were once the vehicle for that, if you wanted to kick the establishment. But Jeremy Corbyn did make Labour now a vehicle for that elsewhere in the United Kingdom, but also in Scotland. And we should just say, just before we leave Scotland, a bit about Ruth Davidson. Apparently, it seems her brand of more positive conservatism seemed to do well compared to, you know, there's quite a contrast there with Theresa May, because the Tories were big gainers in Scotland. But in the rest of the country, it's just this one big phenomenon is the UKIP vote, which we assumed, and again, we were encouraged to by the polling, was going to just migrate from UKIP directly more or less to the Tories. And that first wave of polls that showed Theresa May 20-odd points ahead of Jeremy Corbyn, it was all assumed she had just absorbed the UKIP vote. In the event, it seems that broke you know, maybe even evenly, but certainly a big chunk of UKIP people went to Labour. And it makes me rethink now what those UKIP voters were doing all that time. It wasn't really about Europe and single market and Brexit. In a way, they were just kicking the system out of rage almost.
I think it also makes you re-examine what the Brexit vote was about to some extent, doesn't it? Because there was a feeling at the time, oh, this is perhaps rather reactionary. This is a sort of, anti-immigration vote. It's a rather right-wing thing. And actually, you know, it seemed to have been the Corbynites, to be fair to them, their analysis of it right from the start was this is about parts of the country that feel left behind. This is about people who feel the system doesn't work for them, whose living standards have been squeezed, who haven't got much of a chance. And there's no particular reason to think those people are intrinsically right wing or think that the answer to everything is to close the borders. But they do think we need to shake things up and do things differently.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't expect this result. And even though I voted for Jeremy Corbyn twice in campaign from the first time, I expressed my very public doubts. I felt the polling had turned so badly that it was going to be very hard, or if not impossible, to turn around.
Little faith, Emmy.
I was wrong, absolutely, and others stuck, didn't deviate from that path, and I have the humility to accept that. But the argument we did make in that first leadership race, and I did make it in the page of The Guardian, I'm not doing an I told you so now, but it was ridiculed at the time by many of the commentariat, which was that Corbyn was best placed to win over three groups of people: younger voters, non-voters, and UKIP voters, and Scottish voters as well. And, I think the point about UKIP voters that we made was that these were often working class people who felt very disenchanted for very obvious reasons, particularly in ex-industrial communities that felt completely abandoned and neglected. People said, oh, why didn't they vote for the Green Party? It doesn't work like that. Politics is about sentiments as much as it is about substance. You'd get people who hate Margaret Thatcher, who'd never vote Tory, voting for UKIP, even though objectively they're of more of a Thatcherite party. But I did see it. So I've been travelling all over the country the last few weeks, and I saw it on the ground in Birmingham, Erdington. Nick Timothy, Theresa May's advisors from Erdington, so he was very keen to win Erdington. They thought they had it in the bag to begin with. They told me last Saturday that a third of UKIP voters were breaking for the Labour Party, according to their own results. I met UKIP voters in Ashfield who voted UKIP last time, who said, well, we like the idea of rail renationalisation. I mean, it was there if you wanted to see it.
And Nigel Farage, of all people, was very insightful on this. In the night, he said the Tories always made this mistake. They assumed UKIP voters were basically Tories. And he said, I always told them they weren't. He knew that they were often working class voters and issues like rail nationalisation were important to them. And they were different. No, I do think it was an anti-establishment vote that was driving UKIP and driving Brexit. And the interesting thing is, the more Jeremy Corbyn was demonised by, yes, the media, but also the Tories and his own backbenchers, his own parliamentary party, the more Jeremy Corbyn came to look like a reasonable vehicle for a protest anti-establishment vote. Labour before had seemed like an established party of government. Maybe that wouldn't be where an anti-establishment voter would go, but it would if Jeremy Corbyn was the leader.
I also think the manifesto is quite important too. I think it's not just a negative thing. It's not just a kick against the establishment. It's also, here's a list of quite positive things that we could do and ways that we could do things differently. And I heard from a lot of MPs, even those who were very sceptical about Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, that there were a lot of sort of positive things that they could point to. Tory manifesto, almost no retail offer whatsoever.
Right, we need to wrap up, but it is, I just think, also worth noting again, the right-wing press led a vicious gutter campaign, and many would have thought that would have destroyed him, and it didn't work. And I think this election does call into question the power of the right-wing press as we know it.
And so perhaps before we end, we should take the opportunity just to talk about the state of the various parties. We haven't mentioned at all, Johnny, the Liberal Democrats, have we? They were looking for a what they called a Lib Dem fight back, weren't they? They felt they could voice the concerns of some of the Remainers, and they could sort of surge back in a lot of the seats that they lost in 2015.
And they had a sort of mini fight back in the sense they did gain seats, and they've gotten extra members of parliament that they had, but they didn't get some huge breakthrough, which on June the 24th of 2016 really looked like they would. That there was their 48% were their, easy pickings, you'd have thought, low-hanging fruit for the Lib Dems. And, there was a time when you imagine when we were all convinced, me included, that Jeremy Corbyn could not add seats for Labour, that Lib Dems could really clean up in a lot of those Remain areas. And there was Richmond Park where they beat Zach Goldsmith. So you thought they were really
which he's now won back,
and
of
in
course,
the end, yeah. He's won it back. And so it's been very spotty. They've lost Nick Clegg, who in some ways is the most eloquent spokesman against Brexit in the country of any party. So clued up on sort of European issues. He's now out of Parliament. They lost him, but yet they gain Vince Cable, and they get Ed Davey back, but they lose Richmond Park, as we've just said. So it was quite a mixed night, but not it wasn't a you know, disaster for them. And, you know, Tim Farron, who some of us thought might have to resign if they didn't add a seat or if they lost, instead can say, okay, we've made an advance. But the Lib Dems' main problem is they lost the sort of Remain franchise to really Labour in a lot of ways. And one thing that is very curious about the Labour position on Brexit is a lot of people felt it was a fudge. It was neither Remain nor Leave, and it was sort of all things to all people. Well, that actually turned out to be a bit of an advantage, because Remainers could say, yeah, I can live with Corbyn's position, and Leavers could as well. And so those votes went there rather than benefiting Tim Farron and the Lib Dems.
And it also allowed them to move the conversation on, I think, which they really wanted to do. Owen, UKIP obviously didn't have a particularly great night, and they're now facing another leadership contest.
Well, I think they're redundant now as a political force. I mean, we've seen, obviously, the fact that the Conservatives made the strategic decision to mop up the UKIP vote. That hasn't looked quite as clever a strategy as it initially did, but it has had some impact, because some of the UKIP vote did collapse to the Conservatives. The fear of Labour was that, in particular in the Midlands and the North, even if they kept Labour the votes they got last time, the UKIP vote collapse would be such that all of those seats would just fall into the Tory column. So that didn't happen. But nonetheless, with UKIP, you know, Paul Nuttall has proven himself to be a shambolic leader. He humiliated himself in an interview with Andrew Neil. It was almost impossible to watch that interview, I have to say. And with Brexit obviously happening, with the Tories positioning themselves as they have, and with their electorate dissolving in two different directions, what niche do they have left? I can't see what leader they possibly could present which could reverse their decline.
No, although I'm afraid I did hear Nigel Farage in the early hours saying he might have to rejoin the fray.
I may be in a position where I have no choice but to return, he said, as if it was just like he was dragged by a grateful nation bringing him back into public service. No, I thought that too. Nuttall's gone, and Farage sounds like he's on manoeuvres again.
And as far as the Conservatives are concerned, as we said, they didn't have enough seats to form an overall majority. Theresa May will now have to be a lot nicer to those backbenchers to whom she was rather dismissive, and will have to have endless meetings with the DUP about which policies they can and can't support. Tory backbenchers are already saying to me they think we're heading for another election in the autumn. What do you think, Johnny?
I think she will use that as leverage over them, because I think they can't possibly want that, because now politics is so volatile and so unpredictable. It now enters the realm of the possible that Jeremy Corbyn could fight and win outright a general election, and they will be terrified by that prospect. If seats like Kensington and Canterbury can fall, every Tory MP in the country will be thinking, well, who knows, it could be me next. And therefore, I think they will fear a general election, and therefore that may work to give them some discipline. But it's a reminder of how politics is so often an expectations game, because the Tories are the largest single party. She's there well over 300. Labour is well below 300. And yet, you know, it looks like she's the loser and Corbyn's the winner, all because people were expecting to give him an absolute thumping. She looks like a loser on the morning after.
Yeah. And Owen, we should make that clear, shouldn't we? There isn't really a mathematical path, is there, for Labour to form a coalition government from here?
No, because, unless Sinn Féin abandoned abstention, which they won't do. And they're not going to rely on the DUP. And the DUP have made it clear that they would not support the Labour Party. I'm sure the Labour Party are devastated to hear that.
But they said they wouldn't support it as long as he, Jeremy Corbyn,
as long as
is
he
the
was.
Leader.
And I don't think, with all due respect to the DUP, that the Labour Party is going to change its leader at their behest. Now, in terms of, though, what I do just quickly on that issue about young voters, it is actually quite interesting that after years of, you know, all these attacks on young people, the trebling of tuition fees, the abolition of EMA, the failure to build housing, the slashing of youth services, zero-hour contracts, a discriminatory minimum wage, benefit cuts, I could go on for a very long time, they're scared of young voters.
They've got reason to be now, haven't
they? It's the young peril. There are politicians in this country now who fear a young electorate.
Talk a bit about what you and I talked about in the middle of the night, which I thought would be so interesting to people, about how even people who, you know, were in the field just didn't see this youth thing happening, partly because they're almost impossible to canvass. You knock on doors and they're not there.
I think there's a lot in that. When you knock on doors, frequently you'll get people who are middle-aged or older. It's just the case that younger people tend to be out gallivanting around, having fun and, you know, canoodling and all that.
And so they were just sort of off radar for the political parties. They just didn't know. It was all happening on social media and in other places, but not in a place where you could eyeball it. I think that's true.
I think social media played, again, ridiculed social media. It's all one big bubble. I don't know. I think social media was critical in getting those young people out. There was such a big push. You know, we all had this concerted push to get young people out, drag them out kicking, screaming, WhatsApp your friends, all the rest. I think, so, you know, WhatsApp itself perhaps played a bigger role for younger people than knocking on doors.
Do we reckon Brexit played any part in the youth thing, particularly in the sense of them thinking, we missed that opportunity, if only we could have swung it, we didn't, and now we're not going to let that happen to us again in 2017?
I definitely think that it started a lot of conversations about what kind of country Britain should be and what our future should be, and the sort of political culture of the place. That, yes, I think did make people think that maybe they hadn't had their say, and it was, you know, it was talked about a lot of the time that young people didn't vote, and that made a huge difference. It is fascinating to think, isn't it, that there'll be people sitting in CCHQ thinking, God, what can we offer these people? It's absolutely, because the Tory manifesto, in a way, it had this social care policy, which actually was about trying to rebalance the generations by persuading wealthier, older people to pay more for their care, which is sort of one side of the scale. What it didn't have is what they could offer young people as the sort of upside. There was absolutely nothing in it. And strategists will hopefully now have to think, what on earth can we say? And perhaps turn to, I mean, saw Tory backbenchers saying, Johnny Mercer, for example, the Plymouth MP, saying he thought the results were exciting because they showed there was a new generation who were getting involved in politics. So you do wonder whether everybody will be rethinking their strategies.
Should we just talk quickly about the Labour Party? I mean, the dynamics have now changed. The policy agenda on domestic issues, which Jeremy Corbyn put forward, has undeniably, it's one of the main factors that Labour managed to turn around catastrophic poll ratings. The leaking of that Labour manifesto by whoever is probably one of the biggest strokes of political genius, even if it was done in a hostile way, that we've seen, because it allowed days and days and days of debate and discussion about those policies, and it resonated with people. Now, that domestic agenda now is the settlement, the consensus of the Labour Party, and all MPs now effectively will be expected to sign up to it, and I don't think you'll see much dissent to that, which is extraordinary.
And to be fair,
Blairism is dead.
Yeah, and to be fair, even the most sort of sceptical MPs, you know, as they made their speeches through the night, were saying, you know, like, all credit to Jeremy Corbyn, I was wrong about him. There was a kind of magnanimity about it, and an acceptance that he was a crucial factor in bringing these new voters.
It is an
in.
Amazing thing to reflect on, isn't it? That how many was it? 172 of them voted no confidence in him, and now, in a way, this is Corbyn's party in a deep way that it never was before. You know, those terrible local election results, I wrote at the time that Jeremy Corbyn had to take responsibility for those. By exactly the same token, good results on Thursday night mean he can get to take the credit for those results, and should and will. And it means that Labour Party, I think, absolutely do fall in behind him. That job is his for as long as he now wants it. The discipline that will come with that, the political sort of ownership that comes with that is very, very big asset for him.
So that's it for today. But as the post-election fallout continues, we will be back next week for some more election dailies to discuss what on earth is going on. I mean, blimey, the way things are going, anything could be possible by next week. We will continue, as before, with Heather and Anushka as well at Politics Weekly. Make sure you are subscribed wherever you get your podcast. Do follow us on Twitter at Guardian Audio. I'm at OwenJones84. Johnny's at Friedland, and Heather is at Guardian Heather.
And our producers have been the terrific Phil Maynard and Gabriella Jones. Thank you all very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.